Well, welcome everyone. My name is Jason DeRose. I serve the village here on teaching faculty. And I also serve the village as a member of the board of directors. So if you have want to chat with me just about what it takes to run the village, I am in the second year of a possible 12-year term on the board. So wow. I have to, but it's like you can do 3-4-year terms, but everybody seems to serve for a long time on the board. I use he, him pronouns. Today's session is on religious questions regarding abortion. So if you read the description of this, I think that so often when we hear discussions and debates about abortion, I forgot to finish introducing myself. In addition to being on the faculty and a board member here at Holden, I am also the Western Bureau Chief for NPR News. I'm also the religion editor, so I oversee national religion coverage, and I oversee our LGBTQ rights coverage at NPR as well. It is in that capacity that I actually edit these stories that air nationally on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. So some of these have aired very recently that you'll hear today. Some of these have aired quite a while ago, but all of them talk about religious questions regarding abortion. I think so much of what we hear in national news media is about the religious right and that group's take on abortion. But we don't often hear from more progressive people of faith, what some people call the religious left, and their thinking about abortion. It seems that the way that this argument is always framed is basically Christians versus everybody else, or Christians versus secular people. And so over the last few years, and especially the last few months, we've been trying to complexify that by talking about other points of view from religions that aren't about banning abortion or removing abortion rights. You'll also notice that I'm using the language that we use at NPR around this. We do not use phrases like pro-choice and pro-life, because those are the phrases that the people who are on those sides have chosen for themselves, and we're trying to be descriptive. So we say those who favor abortion rights and those who don't favor abortion rights, or those who oppose abortion rights. So that's the language you'll hear on the air. We do come under some criticism for that, though, because we use the phrase abortion rights. But what we're specifically talking about is the legal right to abortion. Some people might oppose having an abortion for themselves, but they don't oppose abortion rights. So we're trying to be as descriptive as possible when we use that language. Before we get going and listen, I thought we should begin with a poem. We're going to begin and end with a poem. Anybody here heard of the poet Kathleen Norris? Oh, good, some of you have. She wrote a book, became quite famous maybe 30 years ago, called Dakota, A Spiritual Geography. And since I know there are people from the Dakotas here, I thought maybe you've heard of her that way. This is from her book that came out right after Dakota, called Little Girls in Church. And, this is not the poem. This is the poem. So this is called In Praise of Darkness. And there's an epigram before the poem. The epigram is from a short story called The Gift by the writer H.D., Hilda Doolittle. There is beneath the curved superstructure of every temple to God the Father, the dark cave or inner hall or cellar to Mary, near, mutter, pray for us. And this is the poem. In Praise of Darkness. It does not fall. It rises out of the crevasse and ravine to take the hills and mountains, then embrace the stars, calm as the sea rhythm in our veins, ancient and simple as salt. Think of the eye forming in the womb, the egg, the fish, the swimmer. Think of female matter that philosophers disdain and Johns in cheap hotel rooms fill with money or themselves and fail again to return to. Think of the ladies of the night. It does not fall, it rises like a serpent roused from sleep. It shows itself a double helix in the dream of a geneticist who translates the code of life. It simplifies, it breaks all codes, turning seed into corn, talk to wisdom, as day into night takes up the story, always the story, night unto night, the message without a word. Listen, Be still. Be as deep as the dark from which you come. Where we are is home. Only Mutter, pray for us. And that's In Praise of Darkness by Kathleen Norris. So this is a piece that we aired shortly after the Dobbs decision, because we were trying to get responses from people of various points of view. So no one piece is going to incorporate everybody's point of view, but what we were trying to do is get various, we did a series of pieces about various faith traditions' responses to the Dobbs decision, which ended the federal protection for legal abortion. So this was that piece.
Lawsuits are being filed around the country to try to restore abortion access following the Supreme Court's decision. One in Florida argues that banning abortion is a violation of Jews' First Amendment right to practice their religion. Dina Pritchett reports on how Judaism is fairly united in its support for abortion access.
At Brooklyn's congregation Beth Elohim, about 50 people are gathered around the temple steps. Rabbi Stephanie Colin leads them in the ritual of Havdalah, marking the separation between the sacred Sabbath and ordinary time, and between Roe versus Wade and what comes next.
From a time where we felt a little more stable to a time when we feel just a little bit less so, but we have tools for this.
With this modern political frame, people engage in an ancient ritual. They sing, like candles, and affirm, as Rabbi Rachel Timoner says, that abortion rights are a Jewish value.
I want to make sure that everyone gathered here understands that Judaism requires abortion when a pregnant person's life is in danger.
So Jewish law places the importance of life before everything.
Daphne Lazar Price heads the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance and teaches Jewish law at Georgetown.
And when it comes to pregnancy, the life of the mother comes before the fetus. And that should be not a question of debate.
Lazar Price says that in Jewish law, or halakha, a fetus becomes a person at birth, not at conception, not at a certain number of weeks. And until then, this potential life should not be allowed to threaten an actual one.
And then there's the continuum of what does it mean to pose a threat? Is it a direct threat in the imminent moment? Is it something that could cause harm to the mother, either her physical or her emotional health?
Different rabbis will have different answers. This is, after all, a faith with a strong tradition of debate. But on the whole, even the most orthodox rabbis say that putting the fetus on equal standing with the person carrying it is against Jewish law.
It is sometimes a requirement. It is a religious action to have to terminate a pregnancy. And denying the right is a violation of religious liberty.
Of course, Jewish law is not the only factor in Jewish life, says Michal Rauscher, who teaches Jewish studies at Rutgers University.
So it's kind of more of an anomaly that Jewish groups today are relying on halakha for their positions on abortion, because that hasn't necessarily been the way Jewish groups have participated in the public discourse.
Rauscher says that Jewish values, Jewish identity, Jewish history also shape Jewish life, many of which lead American Jews to be, on the whole, more liberal and more supportive of abortion access.
I know rabbis across the country were rewriting their sermons in order to talk about this exact topic, to give space for people to mourn this decision and to think about how to move forward together.
At the Havdalah service at Brooklyn's congregation Beth Elohim, there is a sense of sadness. But as Rabbi Stephanie Colin leads the gathered crowd through the ritual, they're also lighting candles and finding hope in the midst of darkness.
And so we'll fill a cup of juice or wine and we'll lift it. And then we'll taste some sweetness because we will demand it of this world.
That demand can take the shape of a religious liberty lawsuit or appointed service marking the end of Sabbath. Because Judaism is a faith that wrestles with the divine and with the world until they bestow the blessings of justice. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchup.
Okay, so I'd like you to turn to one or two other people, and I want you to think about two questions. What surprised you in this story? And then I want you to think about what what you learned in this story that might change something that you do in your own world, in your own congregation, in your own community. So what surprised you, and then how might it change something that you do? I'll give you 3 or 4 minutes for that, and then we'll come back together. We're going to do the same thing we've been doing all week, where you do not get to say what you said. You only get to say what somebody else in your group says. So you're reporting back. You're like a journalist. It's not about you. It's about what it's about listening to the other person, telling us what they said. So go ahead. Okay, so let's come back together and we'll share what you've heard in your smaller groups. Remember, I'm asking you to not report on what you said, but what you heard somebody else say. You don't have to tell us who that person was in your group, but what you heard somebody else say. Who would like to go first? There's a lot of talking, so I know that...
Someone said something.
Okay.
So what I heard from Sarah was that she was surprised...
No. Sorry.
You wouldn't be a journalist without a microphone.
Well, I wouldn't be a radio journalist.
What I heard Sarah say was that she was surprised about debate being such a common piece in Judaism, and that in her mind it seemed as though other religions are much more top down. So the debate was the surprising piece.
Others? Yes.
Another person in my group brought up the fact of the differentiation of the interpretation of the Old Testament versus in different religions. So it's interesting to hear the Jewish faith's interpretation regards to an unborn life versus others.
Maybe one more person? Maybe somebody up there? Yes.
I'm probably the only Jewish person here, is that correct?
Probably.
Am I the only Jewish person here? Okay. So if anybody wants to talk further afterwards, I'm just offering that opportunity. I will say that something we talked about, you were asking about the balance kind of between, rabbinic debate and scripture. And in this case, they're of equal weight.
I did another piece, and listening back to this piece, I actually think I should have included another point in this story, which is that in much of Jewish theology, one is alive when one takes breath. And so being born would mean like you come out of the womb and you go, and then you're alive, not before taking breath. Which we actually see in the creation stories, that we have life when God breathes life into us, not when there's a lump of clay there. Several of you were here on Tuesday, right, when we talked about the free exercise and disestablishment clauses. So I think a really important question to think about in light of the Dobbs decision is, has making abortion illegal, if states choose to make it illegal, has that established a religion? I mean, from this piece's point of view, it seems like it established one religion's view as the law of the land, rather than taking into account other religions' views of laws in the land. Now, I think that some of the very suit that this piece starts with is going to be that challenge that will probably hit individual states as individual states have or are about to ban abortion rights. Okay, so I want to play another piece for you And I'd like you to think about this question while you're listening to this piece. This piece was, when I edited it several years ago, it was quite surprising to me. So think about a time when you were in a position to say, and I think a lot of people here are probably in this position to say, but not all, and then fill in the blank, but not all Lutherans, but not all Christians, but not all Jews, but not all Presbyterians, something like that. Just think about a time when you've had to have that conversation with somebody. Because I think it happens to many of us, especially as, you know, white evangelical Christianity in America is what is thought of as Christianity in America. And as the mainline Protestant denominations shrink and shrink and shrink, and as, I mean, I don't actually know if Judaism is shrinking or not. I think it's actually a pretty stable group, right? So think about that question, about a time when you have had to say, but not all, whatever.
Before the Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion nationwide in 1973, many women still managed to get the procedure, but getting an illegal abortion from an inexperienced medical provider came with a lot of risk. In some cases, women found help from what might seem like an unlikely source, a network of religious leaders. That group formed 50 years ago this month. Clergy are gathering in New York City this weekend to mark that occasion. NPR's Sarah McCammon brings us their story.
As a 19-year-old college student, Loewy Powell says there were a lot of things she didn't understand.
I was not familiar with the concept of acquaintance rape at that time.
It was 1970, and Powell was beginning her sophomore year at Oberlin College in Ohio when she found herself pregnant after an unwanted sexual encounter. Abortion was illegal in most of the country, but Powell says someone referred her to a local minister for advice.
And to be with someone who was non-judgmental, who was not making assumptions, either about the circumstances of how I got pregnant or what the consequences are of that situation, it was very positive for me to go through that.
Powell says she was clear about one thing. She didn't want to be pregnant. So the minister helped her find a doctor in New York where abortion had just become legal. He was part of a network known as the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion, the group of more than 1,000, mostly Protestant pastors, as well as some priests and rabbis, formed in 1967 and helped thousands of women seeking abortions in the pre-Roe era. One of the founding members, United Methodist minister Finley Schaaf, says he'll never forget the first woman who came to him seeking help for her teenage daughter who was pregnant.
I couldn't help her. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know of any physicians that could perform an abortion. I didn't know where to turn.
Now 86, Schaaf says he was able to help other women through the clergy network. In the early years, the group would send women to Europe or Puerto Rico, if they could afford it, or to trusted doctors in the U.S. who'd secretly perform illegal abortions. A lot was changing for women at the time, including women in ministry.
This was a picture of me at 25. Aww. When I went into, I was ordained.
Barbara Gerlach entered seminary in 1968. By the time she became a minister in the United Church of Christ, she could send women to New York for legal abortions. She says many women appreciated the chance to talk through their decision with a religious leader.
If they were counseling someone, that gave a certain kind of respectability to the decision. Where there was so much stigma and shame and secrecy attached, it also gave dignity to the women who were coming for counseling.
As for Loewy Powell, the college student in Ohio, she later went on to become a minister herself and also worked as a counselor at a women's clinic after abortion was legalized nationwide.
This is complicated. This is not an easy situation. There are reasons why we need to support the decision that women come to, that we don't have one religious view, one theological perspective on the issue of abortion.
Much of the work of the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion was illegal at the time, but as members prepare to reunite this weekend, many say they're proud that they followed their conscience. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
Just as a little coda to that, this group is reforming itself, getting back together now, because they're going to have to do very similar things. Okay, so turn to a different person or a different group of people than you were with the last time, and think about that question, a time when you had to try to explain, not all whatever, not all Lutherans, not all Presbyterians, not all Jews, X. So get together and talk for about 3 or 4 minutes, and we'll come back together after that. You're going to be reporting on what somebody else said, not on what you said. So again, we will do what we have done in the past. I'd like you to report on what you heard from somebody else. Who would like to get us started with what you heard from somebody else? An experience they had having to say, but not all, whatever, and explain it.
So I'll share. Okay. Sure.
My name's John, and I was talking with Joel, and an example that Joel offered up as a situation where not all are a certain way, one of those that he offered up was when transgender youth don't all go through the entire process to become the other gender. And the other one that he mentioned right away that caught my attention as well was the misuse of alcohol. That, and I'm not certain if I got it quite, but that misuse of alcohol is a problem for some, but not all. Yeah, okay. A couple examples.
Okay. Other folks? Yes?
Wait.
It's not about us not being able to hear you. We're recording this. So.
My son-in-law, who is a young person here and had his first child recently and so is in a demographic of people who are starting families, said that he's had this experience a couple of times where people who he knew or knew professionally even knew him to be a church-going person and sought his advice and or counsel regarding a decision to end a pregnancy. Hmm. And he was very surprised, like, why would you think I should have an opinion on this? But also felt that they were expecting him to be somehow advocating for, giving them the other side of the coin of like, well, you should carry on this pregnancy. And he didn't have that perspective. They were surprised. Mm-hmm. And also he was like, I don't really have something to say about this. This is your decision. And they found it surprising, since he goes to church every day, that he wasn't ready to tell
them.
Every day, wow. I mean, every week. Every day would be a lot. Yeah. Every week. That he didn't have, some kind of religious advice to offer. He probably did, but he didn't feel comfortable offering it.
No, that's very interesting. That's a very interesting point. And actually, the final thing that I'm going to have us discuss is how we articulate our religious beliefs around abortion that may be different from the predominant one that is talked about by white evangelicals. I think it's also really important to point out that the Supreme Court decision is not in line with American public opinion. 60% of Americans believe that abortion should be legal in at least some instances. So it is not in line with public opinion. Maybe one other person? Yes.
Well, in my group, it's alternative treatments for oncology, right? And then a nurse. And so in the one case, not all people who are into alternative treatments are anti-vaccine, anti-COVID vaccine. And then not all nurses automatically support all vaccines. There were some anti-vax nurses that were in your group. So, yeah.
Yeah, I remember I edited a few pieces where and during the pandemic where nurses were getting fired or not put on the schedule, I think that's how they handled it, if they declined to be vaccinated. And in fact, one that we talked to, I think she was in Tennessee or Kentucky, I think Tennessee, who basically got her pastor to write the note to get her the religious exemption. Although we looked into it, and she wasn't really a member of that church. It was a pastor who basically would sign anything. And basically, these people became members quickly in order to get these exemptions signed so that they didn't have to get vaccinated. Okay, I want to play another piece. We might get to a fourth piece, but we will definitely get to this third piece. I'd like you to think about this question while listening to this piece, and then I'll have you discuss it afterwards. How might we better articulate our religiously held views on issues like abortion? What are our resources for doing that? And this is open to, like, if you have religiously held views on abortion that, you know, are perhaps only in certain instances or in any instance, but how might we better religiously articulate them, as in using the religious tradition that we are from to articulate that? We've heard some examples already in the pieces, so let's listen to this one.
Now that the Supreme Court has overturned Roe v. Wade, finding and receiving abortion care will take more time and become more difficult for many patients. And that means abortions later in pregnancy are likely to become more common. But there are only a handful of clinics in the U.S. that offer abortion past 28 weeks of pregnancy. One of them is Southwestern Women's Options in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Reporter Grace Benninghoff recently visited the clinic and has this story.
In the pale pink waiting room at Southwestern Women's Options, there is not a single empty chair.
So is there one here?
Yeah.
Thank you.
One woman covers her face, quietly sobbing. Another calmly fills out paperwork in a shirt that barely buttons over her belly. Many patients here have traveled from other states because this clinic offers later abortions. Since Texas restricted abortions last year, the clinic has seen more than twice as many patients per week, almost all of them after the first trimester.
We've had to drastically change the way that we do things here in the clinic because there was no way that we would be able to meet that need.
That's the assistant director of Southwestern Women's Options, Christina. She asked that only her middle name be used because she fears harassment. The spike in demand the clinic has seen these past 9 months is minor compared to what's expected now that Roe has been overturned.
We can only do so much. Like, we can only do what we can do.
Now that abortions are no longer available in many states, later abortion will be more common. It will just take patients longer to get care. While they book flights, save up, and wait for appointments, their pregnancies will, of course, progress. One patient, Beth Vile, traveled from Oregon to Southwestern Women's Options in Albuquerque. She couldn't find a provider in her hometown.
I only had 10 days to figure out where I was going to get an abortion.
After a false negative on a home pregnancy test, a positive during a regular physical, and a visit to a crisis pregnancy center that tried to dissuade her from ending the pregnancy, she learned she was 26 weeks along. She had unstable housing and no family support. She knew she needed an abortion. Her doctor told her about Southwestern Women's Options. They had an appointment available, but the cost of the procedure, a flight, and hotel would add up to about $15,000.
At that point, I thought abortion was out of the question. I didn't know what I was going to do.
She had assistance from a combination of four organizations that help with abortion costs, and a family friend came through. Soon, she was on a flight to New Mexico. But she had some complications with the procedure. She was at the clinic for 20 hours.
My doctor and my nurse stayed the entire time. They slept, one of them slept on the chair next to me. And it was a kind of compassion I had never experienced before.
There are six states, plus the District of Columbia, where abortion is legal at any point in pregnancy. But it isn't always available past 28 weeks. There have always been reasons why someone might need an abortion so late. Fetal abnormalities, life-threatening health risks. But now, with fewer clinics doing abortions at all, that list of reasons will be longer.
These are tender moments. They're hard decisions.
Dr. Curtis Boyd is founder of Southwestern Women's Options.
often these are very wanted pregnancies. Women are devastated. They want to view the baby. Some do, some don't. They want blessings. You know, they've lost their baby. They want that acknowledged.
Abortions after 28 weeks account for less than 1% of all procedures, and they require more specialized care. Boyd says the doctors who provide them face unrelenting harassment.
Arson attempts here on this building, multiple fires set outside. We've had windows broken out. It's endless.
Boyd is not only a doctor, he's also a Baptist minister. Even though the anti-abortion movement is supported by many in Boyd's faith, providing abortions aligns with his religious belief to be of service.
I need to maintain a sense of compassion. We're committed to each other. We are compassionate toward each other's situations and needs.
This is a core belief for Boyd, to give to others all he can to help them succeed. Abortion care is what he has to offer. Even though New Mexico has laws protecting abortion, Boyd isn't certain the procedure will always be legal there. But he is certain about the implications for women.
And they will never have equality if they cannot decide for themselves whether or not they're going to continue their pregnancy. Never.
He says without that right, they will never have the liberty promised to them in the Constitution. For NPR News, I'm Grace Benninghoff in Albuquerque.
I love the surprise in that story. We sort of hint at it when the woman says what she experienced after her abortion was a kind of compassion she'd never experienced before, which I think is a really powerful piece of tape. And then just, you know, 30 seconds later, the doctor says these women deserve this compassion. And then immediately after that, we tell you he's a pastor. And not just a doctor, also a pastor. When I get a reporter who finds a person like that, I'm like, oh, we have to do a story about this person because that is fascinating to me. Okay, so I'd like you to turn to a different person than the other two times you've talked so far and discuss that question about how we might better articulate our religiously held views on this issue, on abortion. I mean, you've heard an articulation from Judaism. You've heard an articulation from a network of 1,000 pastors doing this. And now you've heard it from one pastor's point of view. So turn to each other and take 3 or 4 minutes to have a conversation. Come back together and we will hear what you heard from your conversation partner. So similar to how we did, everybody's still talking. Similar to how we did previous times, I'd like you to report back on something that you heard from somebody that you talked with in your conversation. So not something that you said, but something that somebody else told you about their experience with this. So, who would like to start the conversation?
Yes. I'm like burning with this because Joel just said the best thing that I've heard all week. And that is, there's no asterisk by the cross. There is no condition. It is unconditional, non-judgmental, and should be so regardless of the issue. So.
Okay. Other things that you heard, how can we better articulate our views on this? religiously. Oh. You know, that's, that counting to seven thing really works. Like when you, you know, because really it's like in, it, it's between like five and seven that people start to raise their hands.
So when we were talking and my partner said, it's hard to articulate your position if you're not clear what it is. And so maybe there's like a backing, a step back that we have to take of like, we have to be more clear about what our position is as people of faith before we can really articulate it in a meaningful way.
So right? Do you mean...
So I like that.
Yeah, I think that's great. Do you mean think through it yourself, or like the denomination thinks through it, or how?
I was thinking through it yourself, not just in the terms of like knowing for yourself what it is, but in terms of having thought about how would I say this most effectively and directly and compassionately and with nuance, but also in 10 seconds, like... to have thought ahead of time about the best actual way to express and come to, yeah.
I think that is really important because I think many people who, say, oppose abortion rights have spent a lot of time coming up with their elevator speech. Same way that a lot of people who oppose LGBTQ rights have spent a lot of time coming up with...
Centuries.
coming up with their elevator speech. So I'm not suggesting that people should reduce all of their thinking down to 30 seconds, but it might be helpful to have a really clearly articulated thing to say, because you will, I think, more and more have these interactions with people, especially in a post-Roe era. Many, many denominations have teaching statements around abortion. The ELCA has one that is quite fulsome, actually, that you can easily find by just Googling ELCA social statement on abortion. It's fairly lengthy. I don't remember how old it is. It's actually also quite old. It's one of the older teaching statements within the denomination. And I know that other denominations have similar statements. Maybe one more person? We're going to close with a piece, but one more person perhaps? No? Okay. So I'd like to play this piece for you, which comes out of a very different tradition than all of the ones we've been talking about so far today. So I'm going to say about it before I play it for you.
When parents lose a child, there are rituals to mark their grief, funerals, sitting Shiva, bringing casseroles. But when that loss happens before birth, often it isn't marked. Sometimes it's barely even mentioned. It's different in Japan, which has a traditional Buddhist ceremony. And as Dina Pritchett reports, some Americans are adopting that ceremony as their own.
When photographer Allie Smith was trying for a second child, she had 4 miscarriages. With each pregnancy, she tried to keep her hopes in check. But you can't always help yourself.
There's always a part of you that goes into the future and starts to build a little idea of what your life's going to be like. Once that stops, something very large has stopped for you.
And it can be tough to move forward.
The pain of miscarriage is very private, and you're not even really sure how much you're supposed to be grieving.
Even when that loss is a choice, it can still be a hard one. Catherine Rand is a chaplain who had an abortion in high school.
It has different effects for different people, but for me, I was carrying around a lot of grief for a long time.
And it's grief she couldn't really talk about.
There's going to be a lot of shame, and there's going to be a lot of stuffing stuff down because you don't want to be judged.
Both Rand and Smith decided to come face to face with their grief in a ritual that more and more American Zen centers are offering, Mizuko Kuyo. Zen teacher Jan Chosen Bays participated in one of the earliest American Mizuko Kuyos about 20 years ago.
You know, you have an abortion or a miscarriage, and then you go home, and you're bereft. And you just have to hold it in your heart forever.
Chosen, as she's known, was dealing with pain from her own miscarriage, as well as the pain from her work as a pediatrician specializing in child abuse. Since that first ceremony, Chosen has held several dozen over the years at the Zen Center here in Oregon. Ceremonies begin with making some sort of token, like a bib or a necklace. There are chants, like this one from the monastery residence, to Jizo, who serves as a sort of patron saint for children.
Jizo statues in Japan often look childlike, so that as you make an offering to the statue, you're also making an offering to the child that the statue is, in a way, conflated with, because you don't have that child to hold or care for anymore.
The garden at Chosen's Great Vow Monastery is filled with hundreds of moss-covered Jizo statues, wearing these rain-soaked bibs and bonnets. Walking through, you're hit with the enormity of love and loss it all represents.
You have to be able, when you're holding the ceremony, to hold the grief of an entire room. You have to have equanimity yourself with the fact of death. You're not working with an individual on their individual grief. The ceremony does that work by itself.
That work, balancing love and loss, deals with timeless questions. But Mizuko Kuyo, even in Japan, is surprisingly modern. Jeff Wilson teaches Buddhism at the University of Waterloo.
Kuyo rituals are an ancient format of Japanese Buddhist practice. But Kuyo for Mizuko, for departed child spirits, so far as we can tell, really only goes back to the post-World War II situation.
That's when the Japanese abortion rate rose significantly. A combination of increased legal access, post-war pregnancy boom, and post-war recession. And Wilson says the ritual that developed in response looks different from the American version.
The actual ceremony itself will be almost entirely conducted by the Buddhist priest, and the woman may or may not even be present. The heart of the ceremony there is attention to the feelings of the Mizuko.
In America, the focus shifts from Jizo and spirits to the women and men who have felt a loss. And at the ceremonies, like the one Catherine Rand attended to mark her decades-old abortion, the loss is worked through together.
So the minute we started chanting, the tears just started falling. It's so powerful to hear 35 people's voices raised and to know that they were intentionally raising them to honor this life that had not come into being.
Rand has practiced Buddhism for years, and although she talked about these issues with friends and therapists, the formality and fellowship of the ritual felt different.
I think it was just this real, huge sense of acceptance, like, you are okay, and it's okay that this happened.
And the ceremony wasn't just about making peace with the past. It was also about letting go of stories she'd been telling herself about the present.
That I was not having that child so that I could have babies later on, you know. And as I get older and I don't, that redemption story that was really causing me harm.
Putting down that story helped Rand find some peace, which is what a lot of people are looking for, including Allie Smith, who'd experienced those four miscarriages.
I really wanted to not be sad about this anymore. I really wanted to feel like I could move on and decide, okay, this is what our family looks like. And I was having a really hard time getting to that place.
Like a growing number of American Mizuko Kuyo participants, Allie Smith doesn't have a background in Buddhism. She's not religious at all. But after her miscarriages, she was open to trying anything. So she bowed and chanted. And when the time came, along with the other participants, Smith wrote the names she'd chosen for her miscarried children on a slip of paper.
We took the papers and put them on the altar, and I just remember looking up and seeing there were so many, you know, there were so many little pieces of paper there with so many names on them. All of a sudden, it was impressed upon me the enormity of all the pain that people go through, and you never have any idea.
The idea that life is suffering is one of the essential truths of Buddhism. And seeing that laid out so plainly, especially for losses that are usually so private, can actually bring people some peace. The American Mizuko Kuyo, at its heart, isn't about Jizo statues or chants. It's about compassion for the losses we suffer, for everyone around us, and for the lives all of us are living. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
So I would like to close this session with a short poem, again, another poem from Kathleen Norris's book, Little Girls in Church. It's called A Prayer to Eve. Mother of fictions and of irony, help us to laugh. Mother of science and the critical method, keep us humble. Muse of listeners, hope of interpreters, inspire us to act. Bless our metaphors that we might eat them. Help us to know, Eve, the one thing we must do. Come with us, Muse of Exile, Mother of the Road. Thank you for coming.